The moon is essentially a fossil.
It's only 3 days away if you can get a rocket big enough to get there.
And it went right up to including winged man bats.
The toenail moon, unsurprisingly, is not an official name.
Hello and welcome to the supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, Izzy Clark, and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
Yeah, this month it's all about our mate, the moon. And I feel like, Izzy, I want you to put in like Despicable Me, like the moon,
the moon,
because I feel like it's only appropriate now that we're finally on this episode. We got lots of questions to ask. Where did it come from? What do we know about it? And what is still left to discover?
I know. I mean, it's only taken us 2 years to get to this point, but better late than never, right? So coming up, Professor Catherine Joy from the University of Manchester will be telling us what past and future lunar missions can tell us. Plus, I spoke with Dr. Megan Barford about some of the moon maps that we can find in the Royal Astronomical Society's library.
And obviously, Dr. Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, is here with us as always as well. We talked a bit about this in our December episode, Robert, where we talked about eclipses, but you literally wrote a book about the moon, so we have the best person here.
Yeah, I did with my friend Alexandra Losker, who is an art historian, and we loved this project, I have to say. There's so much, actually, that's so wonderful about it, not just looking at it in the sky, but also the way it resonates in culture. And I think some of my favourite things connected with it are, well, one you can see for yourself quite soon, the Nebra Sky Disc, which is this beautiful bronze and gold disc that was discovered. It dates from 1600 BC, so nearly 5,000 years old. 4,000 years old, discovered in Germany in 1999, and it'll be on display in the World of Stonehenge exhibition in the British Museum, as it happens, just as this podcast goes out for about 6 months. Fantastic. And I also really like the kind of wacky things, like there was this moon hoax story, not faking moon landings. We all know those happen. Please don't email us about this. But where the New York Sun in the 1830s ran a whole series of articles, a paper that no longer exists, about John Herschel, who was the son of one of our founders, William Herschel. And he was working in Southern Africa in the Cape of Good Hope Observatory. And the stories claimed he was discovering exotic life on the lunar surface using a preposterous telescope with a seven-foot lens, and it went right up to including winged man bats. Now, it's wonderful. It's a brilliant story. And then my personal favourite feature on the surface is something called the Moon Maiden, which was drawn on Cassini's first scientific map of the moon in the second half of the 17th century. And I thought this was just an embellishment. I thought Cassini, you old softy, drawing his wife and or lover on the surface of his map. But it turns out that it really does look like that. So if you get a small telescope and you look near Mare Imbrium, which is one of the big basins, there's a feature called Promontorium Heraclides. And with a small telescope or a smartphone camera, it looks like a moon maiden. It looks like a woman with long hair. It's extraordinary. I thought this is just an embellished drawing, but no, it really does look like that. So I love looking at it. I think it's fantastic.
That's amazing. I mean, I know most people would just be, you know, impressed if they get out the telescope. I'm more impressed by the fact that you could pronounce those words that Latin. I would have butchered that.
Yeah, I'm looking at them in the script like, no, not going to try that. But can we start with the basics though, Robert? I mean, how old is the moon and when was it formed and how do we know that?
It's a little bit younger than the Earth. So the most accepted idea for the formation of the moon is it's about 4.425 billion years old. That was refined by about 85 million years fairly recently, about 100 million years younger than the Earth. And the idea is that something the size of Mars, this is in the era of the solar system, bear in mind with loads of stuff flying around when the planets have just formed and there's still an enormous amount of things flying around, something the size of Mars hit the so-called proto-Earth, right? So the Earth before it was the Earth, sometimes called, and the object I think striking it was called Theia, and that cataclysm, that unimaginable collision, you know, planets smashing together, left behind the Earth we have today. Well, it wasn't like the Earth we had today, but it would become the Earth like today, with a very dense iron core left behind, and then we get a strong magnetic field. It becomes very helpful for life, actually, in protecting us. And then the debris that was thrown out by that, the idea is the moon coalesced out of that over decades, that you saw this cloud of debris around what was left of the Earth, and it coalesced together, gravity pulled it together, and you ended up with a much less dense moon left behind. And one of the big clues for that came from the Apollo missions and the rocks they returned to the Earth, where the ratio of the different types of oxygen, the so-called isotope ratio, so imagine you've got oxygen, you've got slightly heavier and slightly lighter atoms of oxygen, and the ratio of those in moon rocks is the same as we find on Earth, so it really strongly supports the idea that the two bodies are connected.
It's a great theory, I absolutely love it, and the one thing I love the most about it is it means that Earth at one point looked a little bit like Saturn, because it had this huge debris disk around it that then formed our moon. And I'm kind of sad it formed the moon. I'd quite like to have rings instead. But anyway, cheers, Robert. We'll catch up with you later in the show to take on some of those listener questions.
Okay, so that is the age and the formation of the moon covered. But what else do we actually know about our rocky neighbour? I spoke with lunar geologist Professor Catherine Joy from the University of Manchester, who started by telling me about the structure of the moon and what it was like billions of years ago.
We're still asking these questions about what the interior structure of the moon is like and how it actually is similar and different to the other rocky terrestrial planets like the Earth, Mars, Venus and Mercury. We think that the moon's core is relatively small, and this is sort of our understanding of the size is really dependent on understanding its early history. So after the moon formed, we think that the early phase of the moon's history is dominated by what we refer to as the lunar magma ocean phase. It sounds quite dramatic, but it basically means that we think that the moon was essentially a big ball of molten magma. And this molten magma cooled, and as it cooled, different crystals or different phases precipitated out of this kind of early hot magmatic body. And the dense ones sank to the interior to form that core and the mantle. And then the lighter material that formed kind of later on in this early phase actually floated up kind of out of the magma towards the moon's surface. And this is the material that gives rise to those white areas on the moon. We call them the lunar highlands. But that's why the moon is white, because it formed in this early phase of the moon's history.
And then if you look at the moon, as I'm sure many of us have done, then you see like these black patches, which are what we call the seas. So can you explain what those are and what do they tell us about the moon?
So after the moon gained this crust, this sort of white area of the highlands, it was heavily bombarded by things hitting the moon's surface, asteroids and comets that were migrating around in the inner solar system, striking the surface, carving out massive basins, hundreds to thousands of kilometres in diameter. These created topographic lows, so lowlands across the surface of the moon. And then slightly later on, we think that the moon's interior partially melted. So we had magmas that were generated, which these magmas migrated up through the moon's crust and erupted at the surface as volcanoes, much like we see in places like Hawaii or Kilauea, and also in places like Iceland. It's a very similar type of volcanic activity, fire fountaining, and it's those that give rise to those black, dark seas that we see infilling these big impact craters on the moon.
Yes. So why don't we still have those today? Do we know what happened?
So we had volcanism on the moon. We think, well, we constrained this using some of the samples that we've collected from the moon itself. And we've also looked from orbits to sort of calculate the ages of some of these surfaces. And we think that the moon's volcanic activity lasted from about 4.3 billion years ago, which is quite a long time, to as recently, certainly, as 2 billion years ago. And that new age, that youngest age, has been constrained by a very recent mission that China has performed to bring back some of these volcanic rocks here to Earth that we've been able to age date. But the moon may even been as active as 1 billion years ago, which is really remarkable for such a small planetary body, which you imagine would run out of energy and heat to kind of generate this melting in the interior. It's actually pretty recent, and so it's fascinating to ask the question of, well, what drove the moon's heating for such a long period of time? And that's something we'd really like to understand in the context of terrestrial planets' diversity. So, you know, how does that differ from Mars and Venus and all these bigger bodies in the inner solar system?
So obviously, there have been missions to the moon, but what have they collected and, you know, what have they told us that helps better our understanding of the moon?
Yeah, so the moon's fantastic. It's, you know, it's only 3 days away if you can get a rocket big enough to get there. But we've sent this, you know, a plethora of missions to the moon. It's quite incredible. All, you know, all the way from the earliest missions that sort of were flyby missions that took photographs through to really sophisticated orbital mapping missions pointing a huge array of different experiments down at the surface where we've looked at the moon's chemistry from orbit. We've looked at the topography. We've looked at the mineralogy. We've even taken high resolution photographs where you can see things on the moon's surface down to 50 centimeters in size. Incredible detail. So we've got this, you know, this global data set of remote sensing data, which has been, we're able to compare all of these to help generate and test our models. But for me, being a geologist and being a person that loves studying rock samples, the best thing is we have the samples that have been collected from the moon. And these include the nearly 400 kilograms that were returned by the Apollo missions from the six locations on the near side. We have about 300 grams from the Russian missions that visited the eastern limb of the moon. And then most recently, just a year ago or just over a year ago, we have the new Chinese samples that returned 1.7 kilograms of moon rock from the near side. And so this collection is, you know, really valuable where we can take small pieces and put them in our machines and age date them, measure their chemistry, their isotopic history to piece together our ideas of how the moon had evolved through time. But we're really not satisfied. You know, we really want more samples because we've only visited the near side. We've never been to the far side of the moon with a lander mission that can bring us back moon rocks as of yet. And so that's what we're really hoping that the next generation of lunar explorers is going to do for us.
And I think it's the far side of the moon that has been spoken about quite a lot recently when we're talking about missions. So what is it about the far side of the moon that we want to explore? What's the attraction, I suppose?
So the attraction is we've just not really been there.
Yeah. You know,
it looks very different to the near side. So the near and far side of the moon, when you look at a picture of comparing the two hemispheres, the far side of the moon actually has very few of those mare basalts, those seas that you mentioned earlier on. It seems to mostly be white in appearance, and its surface is dominated by large impact craters, one of which is huge. It's actually the biggest impact crater in the whole of the solar system. 2,500 kilometers in diameter. And so really what we want to do is we want to get into that impact basin, look at the rocks that are there to test whether it could have excavated down into the lunar interior, into this mantle kind of lower material below the crust. And that can inform us about kind of the moon structure.
Yeah. And, you know, with any mission and exploration in space comes the question of water. Is that something that we're looking for on the moon, or signs of it in whatever form that takes?
So the water is really critical for human exploration, because eventually, you know, in tens of years time, we're going to hopefully learn to live off the land wherever we go and utilize reserves and reservoirs of water to do things such as support bases that we build for sustainable living on planetary surfaces, and also eventually to convert into rocket fuel to make it easier to travel back and forth between different bodies in the solar system. So water is critical. Now, on the moon, we've always thought of the moon as a very, very dry body. And for the vast majority of areas, that is true. But we now know from, again, some of the analysis of samples that have been returned from the moon, and also from some of our orbital remote sensing data, that there's places on the moon that may have elevated water concentrations. And we even think in the polar regions, in impact craters that never see the sunlight, there could be reserves of icy material mixed in to some of the local soils. And these icy reservoirs could be really interesting places to go to. But we need, I know I keep saying we don't know anything. We really don't know how much is there. And actually a lot of the upcoming exploration is really targeted to ask that question. What is in those craters? How much is there? What is it made of? Is it all water, or is it in the other form of volatiles? And then eventually, how can we tap into that to use it in a sustainable way?
Thanks very much to Catherine Joy from the University of Manchester. So there's quite a lot to unpack there. But Becky, hearing about the structure of the moon actually got me thinking, if it's had this molten core, do we know if the moon ever had a magnetic field?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, because, I mean, theoretically, if it had a molten core, it's got moving electronic charges, which produces a magnetic field, right? And so, yes, it could have actually had a magnetic field at some point in the past. We don't, it doesn't anymore. Presumably that core has solidified and those charges have stopped moving around. What's really cool is that, you know, some of the evidence that we have for it having a magnetic field in the past comes from the Apollo mission lunar rocks that were brought back, that Robert was talking about earlier as well. You sort of see the alignment of various, you know, metals that suggest there was a magnetic field, you know, around about 4 billion years or so ago, you know, right after the moon formed. But the big debate that's still ongoing is whether actually the moon did have a magnetic field, or whether you had these sort of like little bursts of magnetic field being created from various different impacts by, you know, when there was this huge heavy bombardment in the early days of the solar system. You know, in those collisions, you could generate these magnetic fields that would cause this alignment, and then maybe that's what's caused it rather than the moon as a whole having a magnetic field. So we're not entirely sure. We'd need more moon rocks to know. You know, we need a bigger sample to actually study. So from different places on the moon and also of different ages as well to try and pinpoint, you know, is this something that happens sporadically? Then it's probably impacts, or whether it was really concentrated on one age of rocks, right? And then it's probably a global magnetic field. So we've got a bit of a limited picture from the Apollo moon rocks. So maybe that's a reason to go back.
Yeah, absolutely. And can studying the moon tell us anything about Earth's history as well?
Yeah, I mean, the moon is essentially a fossil, right, that can tell us about Earth and moon shared history, because there's no plate tectonics, there's no weather, right, to make those older rocks disappear. Those older rocks are still there. They've not been destroyed like they have been on Earth. And, you know, it's why the astronauts' footprints will all still be there in, you know, hundreds of thousands of years as well, because there's no weather on the moon. So because it's this sort of like almost like perfect fossil, you can find out, you know, when when we had a larger amount of impacts in the solar system, when the impacts were impacting, I guess, you know, and that'll be true for both the moon and the Earth as well. One of the really cool things that we could do as well by studying moon rocks and studying the moon as sort of like this fossil is work out if water was brought to the Earth and the moon system by comets and asteroids, when did that actually arrive as well? Can we see that in sort of the rock history on the moon that's lost to us on Earth? Even there's also one possibility as well that, you know, if you had a lot of impacts on the early Earth, that would have thrown up, especially if they were very big impacts, like ejecta out into space, right? If you imagine, yeah, right, a big impact and it throws stuff back out, that ejecta could then land on the moon. So you could have very old Earth rocks that no longer exist on Earth because they've been destroyed in plate tectonics, you know, just turned back into lava or whatever, you know, that are now on the moon and we could find on the moon. So people are always searching in the Apollo samples for something weird that shouldn't be there, that you know, doesn't belong with all the moon rock as well. So we're always keeping our eyes peeled because, you know, no idea what the moon could teach us, really, what surprises it might have in store.
Who doesn't love looking up at the moon? And in the 1600s, it was quite the thing to do. The telescope had been recently invented, and so astronomers turned their attention to study our bright neighbour. This created various moon maps, which are great works of art that documented the craters that are etched onto the moon's surface. I spoke with Dr. Megan Barford, curator of cartography at the Royal Museum's Greenwich, who told me about some of the moon maps in the Royal Astronomical Society's archive.
So today we're going to be looking at two maps, one which was published in 1651 by Jesuit astronomers Giovanni Riccioli and Francesco Grimaldi, and one that was published a bit later in the 17th century, so in 1679, by Jean-Dominique Cassini.
So let's start with this first one by Riccioli and Grimaldi. So I'm looking at it now online. Obviously, we're doing this over Zoom. And it's incredibly detailed from something from the 1600s. Talk me through it.
I guess one of the first things to say is that this map is part of a book, the Novum Almagestum, so the New Almagest, which Riccioli published as a kind of new encyclopedia of astronomy. And one of the really important things in the 17th century to include, one of the kind of novel things to include, was a map of the moon. The telescope had been invented in the early 17th century, so the first recorded evidence of the telescope we have is from 1608, and it very quickly spread throughout Europe. Astronomers were fascinated by the possibilities, and because the moon is bright and close, it was one of the first objects that astronomers turned their telescopes to. And what they saw was extraordinary. Suddenly the moon became a celestial body that had valleys and craters. It had a landscape. So what we can see here are sort of craters with shadows. We can see the kind of dark plains, which Riccioli describes as seas. So we know now that these are lava plains. You'll notice that the map isn't a sort of perfect circle, that there are kind of two segments at either end. And that's because over the course of time from Earth, you can actually see slightly more than half of the surface of the moon. And that's because the moon travels at a constant speed around an elliptical orbit, which basically means you see the kind of ears they're sometimes described as. It's known as libration, basically kind of apparent lunar wobble, which means that you can see more than half of the surface at once.
I love that. We know that the moon has craters, but it also has ears. That's great. So, and they are detailed. I mean, we have what looks like a map of the moon. As you say, we've got this circle, there are dark patches, we've got craters that we know, but it's labelled and it's everything has a name. It's all written on here. So, you know, how long did it take to make this? Do we know?
The history of mapping is often a history of copying and compilation, as well as of observation. So when Riccioli and Grimaldi make their map, they draw on work that's been done. I mean, this map is actually made by Grimaldi, and then Riccioli comes up with the naming system. So they draw together existing moon maps. They check them against their own observations in order to compile this map. The system of naming which Riccioli develops for lunar features is broadly the one that we still use today. So in the 17th century, as astronomers start to name lunar features, there are various different methods proposed for kind of how to set it out. So one of the first moon maps that has a lot of names on uses the names of kind of Catholic nobility in Europe. A few years later, a Polish astronomer, Johannes Hevelius, does extensive observation of the moon and says, well, the lunar surface looks a little bit like the geography of the countries around the Mediterranean. So we can name various of these features after the Mediterranean, after islands and mountains. Riccioli comes along and says, well, I mean, it just doesn't, does it? and is also kind of wary of naming these lunar features after contemporary political figures. That seemed like asking for a whole lot of trouble, right? So he decides to use for sort of features, so for particular craters, the names of astronomers. So if you look, you might see Azofi, which is named for Al-Sufi, a great sort of medieval Islamic astronomer, Eratosthenes, so an ancient Greek astronomer. And then you also see the sort of seas, which are named after emotions or kind of weather. So you have the Sea of Tranquility, the Bay of Rainbows, and so on.
Let's look at this Cassini map because I love it. I think it's stunning. And just a reminder to listeners, we have put links to these images on the episode description. So please go and have a look at them because they are incredible. So I'm thinking this is, you said this was from 1679.
That's right. And it's an absolutely beautiful engraving. You know, you can see sort of the craters, the valleys, the plains. One of the sort of fascinating things about this map is how clear Cassini was about the kind of practical function of moon mapping. Maybe someone said something a bit snide to him, right? And so he goes on a bit of a, those who do not look at things in depth think that maps of the moon are useless descriptions of an imaginary country. And what he says is that actually there's a really practical purpose of mapping this place that people will never go, which is about establishing terrestrial longitudes. So this is a bit of a complicated one, but basically, if two observers, different places on Earth, measure the time during a lunar eclipse that the shadow passes over the surface of the moon, over a particular lunar feature, then you can establish the relative longitude between those two observers. And that's something that a lot of 17th century astronomers emphasised, that kind of you know, okay, this has a very distinctly practical purpose. So Cassini says that this serves to mark very precisely the places of Earth and to improve geographical and hydrographic maps, without which it is impossible to make long journeys and to trade with far-off people. So his eyes are on imperial trade networks and long-distance voyages of the 17th century.
How did they and these maps then influence society, and what was their impact?
It's an absolutely fascinating subject, which takes us to kind of ideas about life on other worlds and ideas about the place of the Earth in the cosmos. There had been an idea that the universe is geocentric, so Earth-centered, and that everything beyond the Earth was perfect and unchanging, held in spheres which kind of rotated independently of each other. Now, the idea of something being perfect and unchanging was pretty dramatically challenged, in particular by the moon observations of Galileo Galilei. If you've got craters and valleys and hills, that shows that this is a surface which isn't unchanging. If the moon is somehow analogous to the Earth, that means the moon has a history of change. That means not only does the moon have terrestrial features, but it also means that the Earth becomes a celestial body. And this challenge to thinking about the moon and the place of the Earth in the cosmos is kind of cemented by the observation that Earth's moon is not the only moon. So Galileo also sees the moons of Jupiter, at which point the Earth is no longer the only body around which things rotate. And so together these lunar observations form a massive challenge to the way that the place of the Earth is thought of. And as this kind of observation of lunar landscapes develops, there's sort of increasing speculation of like, well, if this is a landscape, does that mean there's life there? And in the 17th century, this is also cause for a huge amount of theological worry about sin and salvation, essentially. So do beings on the moon, are they affected by Adam's sin? And a lot of theologians say no, but if Christ died once and for all, salvation is for all. Does that extend beyond the Earth? Some have, you know, these kind of incredibly complex reasonings about the possibility of growing grapes on the moon, and therefore the possibility of wine, and therefore the possibility of the Eucharist. And since the moon is too cold to grow grapes, then a loving God would not allow there to be life on the moon, which would remain in a state of sin because of the absence of the Eucharist. This is something that Oliver Morton talks about in his book, The Moon, A History for the Future.
Right.
So if you want to read more about that, definitely.
Amazing. We actually do Space Book Club, so we'll put it on the list.
Thanks so much to Dr. Megan Barford, and their book, A is for Atlas, Wonders of Maps and Mapping, will be out in May later this year. And don't forget, you can see the pictures of the moon maps that we discussed in our show notes.
This is the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society, with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
This month we're exploring one of our favourite topics, the fabulous moon. To be honest, I'm amazed that we've actually got this far through the episode without you mentioning, dare I say, the toenail.
Yeah, I got toenail moon earrings in today and everything. I wore them for our moon episode.
I literally saw one the other day and you were the first thing I thought of, and I was like, for goodness sake.
I love my joy for the toenail moon has infected others, and we need a hashtag.
No, we don't need that. I mean, Becky, do you want to explain this for our new listeners, the ongoing saga of this blooming toenail moon?
Sure. So the toenail moon, unsurprisingly, is not an official name for this phase of the moon. The phase of the moon we're talking about is the crescent moon. I have always loved a crescent moon. I think it looks the most beautiful in the sky, but I also think it happens to look a little bit like toenail.
One of the worst things that you could compare it to.
I mean, maybe fingernail might have been better, but still, like, it just, that's what it reminds me of. It's what I've always called it. And do you know what? The name has now stuck. And I love the fact that people see the moon and think of me and toenails.
And toenails, lovely. Such a nice image. Mm. So one thing that we actually haven't discussed yet is humans returning to the moon.
Right.
And there's quite a few big steps happening this year to get to, you know, towards that. Sure. So what are the plans that are in motion at the moment?
Well, I think one of the things that stopped us from going back in the past, I don't know, 50 years or so since the Apollo missions has always been money, right? And I think there's been a bit more money ploughed into this in recent years to get us back as sort of a stepping stone to get to Mars has always been the idea, right? So, I mean, we could just build another tin can, right? And chuck some people on it and, you know, keep our fingers crossed that everything was okay. We could do that. I don't think that's probably how we'd want to do it this time. And also, we wouldn't want to go back just for the sake of it. We'd want to go back to do something new for a purpose, for science, that kind of stuff. So you need a couple of things to go back. The Saturn V rocket is no longer in operation, so we're going to need a really really heavy launch rocket, as they call them, that can launch very heavy payloads. So NASA's working on like the SLS, for example, but you've also got SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket as well. And then also you need something to house your astronauts, and ESA's working on sort of a capsule that could house your astronauts. But also, again, SpaceX have got their Dragon capsule that's taking people to the ISS that could be adapted for astronauts, you know, for going to the moon as well. But once those things are all in place, like, what's the argument for going back to the moon? What do you do? Well, I think the argument always has to be, it always has to be science motivated, really. So, and we talked about before about getting more moon rocks to study various different things about the origins of water and the history of our own planet and what we can learn, stuff like that. I think the plans and NASA's plans, I think it's back in 2025 is the goal. It was 2024, but it got pushed back a little bit. And I think the plan is to build a space station around the moon. You know, the International Space Station has shown us for the past, 20, 30 years, how long it's been up there, that it is possible to have humans in space for that long amount of time, and it's safe as well. And so it can be used, if you have a space station around the moon, to refuel various different missions and restock various different missions. But also you could have astronauts living up there long term and then sort of just, you know, doing pops to the surface, like a pop to the shops, right? And you just pop up and pop back up. It's the idea of making perhaps that a little bit safer than, you know, an 8-day round trip or something, quick trip to the moon, that kind of thing. And then obviously going forward, it's then that's a launch base to get to Mars, because it's much easier to launch a rocket from the moon than it is from the Earth because of the lower gravity. And so I think that's really interesting ideas. You know, it's two sort of reasons, science and then onward to Mars. And then also people talk about mining the moon and stuff like this, but there's lots of, you know, is that the right thing to do? Yeah. Philosophical, cultural reasons about whether you should do that, who owns the moon, all of this legal stuff around space that comes into play as well. But I think, you know, the science motivation of understanding more about the moon system, and then also the science motivation of wanting to send humans to Mars as well to investigate further, I think that's definitely the reasons that, you know, we'd want to go back.
Yeah, because it does blow my mind that only 12 people have been to the moon. Like, you just think, it's 3 days away. Yeah. And there was this, you know, there was a rush, and like, now we're done. Like, oh yeah, done that.
You know, it's just like three trips to Australia and loads of people have
done that.
I think it was more like the tin can issue that probably held people back. But it is a strange thing to think that. But like I said, I think it's money, you know, like it costs a lot to do this kind of space travel. And, you know, like all science, you have to buy for funding, you have to justify it, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think probes have been the best way of exploring in the past 50 years. It's much safer, it's much cheaper, but there comes a point where, you know, there are some things that you want people on the ground for.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you to everyone who has sent in their questions about the moon. Quite a lot of you have piled in on Twitter, which is great. So we've got some of them for you, Robert and Becky. Robert, do you want to take this one from, now I think it's Astronosurf. I think we say it with confidence. And they ask, why have NASA and other space agencies decided to return to the South Pole of the moon instead of the North Pole? And I guess first off, you know, what do we actually know about the moon's poles?
Well, the moon's poles are one of those great coincidences in astronomy, because it turns out that the tilt of the moon on its axis makes it pretty much perpendicular to the sun. So because of the tilt of the moon and then the tilt of the moon's axis compared with the orbit around the Earth, the tilt of the Earth's orbit around the sun, all of those things combine to mean that basically you don't get seasons on the moon. So you imagine the axis of the moon is sort of sitting bolt upright compared with the sun. And if you compare that with the Earth, you know, we've got an actual tilt, we get winter and summer and so on. And what that means in turn is that there are regions, particularly at the South Pole, where you have close to, not absolutely, but close to perpetual sunlight, and also deep craters where you get close to perpetual darkness. It's particularly pronounced in the South Pole, to answer the question from AstronoSurf, because it also coincides with something called the Aitken Impact Basin, which is an enormous feature from an ancient impact that is 2,500 kilometers across and as much as 8 kilometers deep, so absolutely huge. And if you have deep craters in that, then they're in almost perpetual darkness. There's some evidence they get little bits of light. And that, what that in turn means is that the stuff Becky was talking about earlier, where you get asteroids and comets depositing water on the moon, if that's been dumped into those craters, there's quite a lot, and when I say quite a lot, you know, perhaps a few percent or more of water ice mixed in with that soil. So it might be an interesting place to put something like a moon base, because you could access that water, probably do things like make rocket fuel from it, break it into hydrogen and oxygen. And also, if you had a base there with solar power that could almost always see sunlight, you could run it that way too. So that's why there's so much interest in it. And there are actually some missions coming up. Even this year, there's a Russian mission called Luna 25 that might land near the crater Boguslavsky, which is in the south lunar pole region. I know the pronunciation, I hope I got that right. And it's not the first time we've explored it. There was a mission, I think more than a decade ago now, called L-Cross, where an impactor was thrown at the crater Cabeus near the South Pole, kicked out a plume of material. And by analysing that plume, the astronomers on Earth could, then with the orbiter probe that was associated with it, could see that there was water ice, evidence for water ice in the plume. So it's pretty much confirmed that water is there. And there's a great deal of interest in it. If you go to the North Pole, on the other hand, it's more distributed. In the South Pole, it seems to be more concentrated in the craters. So that's why there's so much interest in it.
Did you see the exhibition they had, or it was like sort of an installation at Bath Abbey? Where they had the projection of the moon on this huge sphere that they hung from the ceiling, and people could walk underneath it and around it. And my sister went, and she said, like, she stood directly under it and looked up at the South Pole and was like, what on earth is that? Like, she'd never seen it
before. Was that the Museum of the Moon? Was that the
one. I think fantastic. It did a bit of a tour around the UK, because I remember that it was also in Ely Cathedral as well.
He has 7 of those, apparently. I know him. He lives up the road from me in Bristol, and he has 7 of these moons traveling around the world all the time. It's so popular.
Can I have one in my flat? That would be really great.
Does your flat have a 7-meter high ceiling?
Surprisingly, no.
Even has 7-foot ceilings.
Amazing. Well, thanks, Robert. And Becky Siraj, who's in Mumbai, has this question. And a fundamental part to it is the fact that the moon is slowly moving away from us. So he says, at what speed is the moon moving away from our Earth, and what will be the consequences for our planet if that happens?
Yeah, so, I mean, the moon moving away from Earth, right? It comes back to this idea of this giant impact that Robert was talking about before at the beginning of the episode, right? That the moon formed from the debris that was left over from it, which was obviously a lot closer in than our moon is now. You know, as I was saying before, it looked like Saturn, right? That's what you should picture at the beginning. It had this huge, big, dusty debris around it. And it's been moving away from us ever since. And the speed it's moving away is 3.78 centimeters per year, which I think is faster than even than your fingernails grow, or it's around about that same kind of speed.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
It's similar. And it's all to do with this gravitational tug of war between the moon and the Earth, right? The moon, it's not just that the Earth pulls on the moon and keeps it in orbit. The moon also pulls on Earth. It creates these bulges in the oceans that then create our tides, right? And you have two, because it's sort of like, you know, every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? But if you're picturing sort of that happening, and you're picturing the bulges in the ocean lined up perfectly with the moon, that's not actually how it happens. The bulges are actually ever so slightly ahead of where the moon is, and that's because the Earth is also rotating as well. So because they're ever so slightly ahead, the moon is almost always pulling them back a little bit as well, pulling on Earth's rotation. And so you get this exchange of energy where the moon steals a little bit of energy from the Earth's rotation. And so you slow down the Earth as you sort of speed up the moon in its orbit. And so it moves ever so slightly further away from the Earth. And they've been doing that for 4 odd billion years, right? Moving ever further and further away. So it doesn't just mean the moon's moving further away. It also means that the Earth's day has been getting longer. So in the past 4.5 billion years or so, it's gotten 19 hours longer. So when the moon was first formed, the Earth's day was only about 5 hours long. And we know that because we can actually study this in coral growth as well, which I think is amazing.
That's weird,
I wanted to be
amazing.
A marine biologist. This is a great crossover for me as well. You can study coral growth, and you can also look at the fossil records, and you can see that there's, you know, this change in the length of the day over time. And if we think about that going into the future with what Siraj said with consequences on Earth, it could be a bit of a big deal, at least far in the future. Because if we think about the Earth's rotation slowing down, like think about when you set a spinning top spinning and it starts to slow down, like what happens to it? It starts to wobble, right? Like all over the place. So Earth's rotation could become a little bit unstable around its axis, like Robert was talking about before, right? And it's our axis that gives us our seasons. So if that axis is wobbling around, we could have these really severe swings in temperature from hot to cold. We could lose our seasons. We could not have regularity to our seasons, you know, and all life on Earth has evolved to cope with the seasons. And so if that changes, you know, it would be a huge, huge concern. But we're talking about, you know, billions of years in the future here. So it's not something we should really sleep over.
Exactly. I was going to say, and do we even know at what point that, you know, a distance that it has to get to, or probably not?
I didn't look that up. I should have done, but I don't know what it is. I presume it's another 4.5 billion years in the future, you know, in terms of how slow the Earth's rotation has to get. But yeah.
Fair.
It's not tomorrow.
Yeah, thank goodness. I've got plans. Yeah. Robert, Chris Baldwin wants to know, are other moons tidally locked around their host like ours?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Chris. And I confess I knew that there were some, but what I hadn't appreciated was that the bulk of the bigger moons, the bigger natural satellites in the solar system, are indeed tidally locked. What that means, I should say, is that it's keeping the same face to their planet. So like the moon, more or less keeps the same face to us as it goes around. So it takes as long to rotate as it does to revolve. There's a really nice demonstration you can do with a spinning chair and this kind of stuff, which I can't easily convey in the podcast another time. But most of the moons of Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune are all like that. And the ones that aren't, where they're not tidally locked, tend to be smaller and further out. So you've got less, a weaker gravitational interaction. And interesting example of this as well is Pluto, the dwarf planet, and its satellite Charon. They are locked to each other. So both the dwarf planet and the moon going around it always keep the same face to each other. Mm.
I like to you picture also see it like it two there. Friends holding hands and spinning.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking, actually, it's a shame this is probably going out after Valentine's Day, because I thought, actually, that's quite, you know, we could have this romantic illusion of the moon and the planet perpetually keeping the same face to each other.
Yeah, well, people can bear that in mind for next year, I suppose.
Exactly. Card companies and so on.
Becky, Ashley King from Manchester asks, is there a link between the moon's size and its impact on Earth's tides? For example, if the moon was suddenly 50% larger, would tidal levels increase 50% too?
Yeah, 100%. It's a gravitational effect, this tidal effect, right? So it depends on the mass and the distance, what gravitational pull the oceans feel. So if the moon got 50% heavier, your tidal force would be twice as big. If it was only half the distance as it is now, if it was closer to us, then the tidal forces would be 4 times bigger, because it depends on divided by the distance squared, right? Let's clarify Ashley's question. So if the moon was suddenly 50% larger, I didn't know if they meant mass or size. So if it just swelled to 50% larger and got a lot less dense but stayed the same mass, like it just sort of, you know, like a puffer fish just blew up a little bit, then that wouldn't change the tides, because it's the same mass that's still pulling. So I think that's good to clarify. But it does mean, if we think about, again, the moon being closer to us in the past and now moving further away, you can imagine what the tides were like on the very early Earth, right? They were huge, because they were, you know, so much stronger. Even at half the distance, they were 4 times stronger. So you can imagine no one was building beautiful coastal mansions back then, because they would probably be wiped out by what we would call a tsunami. So,
Well, thanks for answering those, guys. And also, just for listeners, we are going to be returning back to the topic of the moon. It's not over yet. Later on in the year to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the last man on the moon, Gene Cernan. But if you want to get in touch in the meantime with any questions, then you can email them to podcast@res.ac.uk or tweet at Royal Astrosoc. So that's almost everything for this month. But Robert, if people want to do a little bit of moon gazing, what are your top tips? What should they look out for?
Well, one thing you can say about the moon, right, is it's the easiest thing to find in the night sky, as you know, always, right, if we have a clear sky. But it turns out that in February and March, and April, actually, the moon is particularly good. It's in the evening sky, it's high up, and the best time to look at it for seeing some of the things we've talked about is around what's called first quarter, which is a quarter of the way through the lunar month, when the moon is about half illuminated. And in the weeks ahead, that's on the 10th of March, when the line will be pretty much down, you know, halfway, so you'll have half of it lit up, half of it in darkness. And that bit there, the so-called terminator line, is the line between sunrise. Basically, it's the sunrise line. So what you see is that as you look through a telescope is all these mountains and craters with very strong shadows. So they really, really stand out. So it also makes the craters look much deeper than they are. The mountains look really dramatically high.
It's like golden hour for photographers.
It's absolutely fantastic. Exactly. And if you pick up, so look at it with your naked eye, there's always a beautiful sight in itself, but pick up a pair of binoculars even, you'll see those mountains and the bigger craters like Copernicus, Plato and Tycho all stand out really well. If you get a small telescope, you can look at those same big craters and even see craters inside them. If you're able to confirm the fact the moon has literally been pelted throughout its history, you can see it for yourself so easily. And at the same time, you also can spot some of the more subtle features, like these wrinkle ridges where lava plains contracted, and there's this famous straight wall fault, which is this sort of slope, and it looks like at the right time, which is a day or so after first quarter, so probably around the 11th of March, you see this weird straight line, which is just the angle illuminating, it sticks out. So fabulous things to see.
I mean, I loved it in the first lockdown of just really connecting with the moon in sort of just in nature, where you can just, you'd get a full moon and all you need is either, you know, I had, I think I just used binoculars and a smartphone, but just being able to take lovely pictures of the moon, it's so easy. So if anyone hasn't done it, I would really recommend just doing it, because it is amazing how much you can see with such a simple setup.
Although with a smartphone won't work, right? Because they're designed to mimic like your actual, like what you would see with your eyes. So the field of view is like almost 180 degrees at sometimes, right, 90 degrees. And so the moon only being half a degree across means it only fills like one 180th of your field of view, which is why it looks tiny and why any smartphone picture of the moon that's, you know, not got binoculars in between or whatever it is looks terrible.
You can cherish that phone moment for yourself.
hold it to a telescope, though. Exactly. I mean, I'm always amazed, you know, how good the photos are. I mean, you can get, if you spend a little money, you can get things that will, smartphone holders. I did try one of those out, and that's great. Actually, makes it so easy to take pictures. But even in many cases, I think people who are absolute experts at smartphone photography can just line up their smartphone at night on even quite faint things, but definitely the moon, get great pictures. It's really, really easy to do, and you just crop it when you process it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what about some of the other things that we can see in the night sky this month?
So we're now moving away a bit, you know, eventually from winter, although it might not quite feel like it, into the spring stars. You can still see those fabulous winter constellations earlier on in the evening, Orion and so on. But I would say look out for things like Leo, the lion, which will be really high in the south from later on in the evening. And it's one of those constellations that actually, to me at least, looks a bit like a crouching lion. It's got this mane, this sickle of stars rising up from the star Regulus at the bottom. And it, you know, does, it's very easy to imagine the lion crouching there. And if you've got a dark sky site, you can do things like try to spot features. There's a, probably need a small telescope for this. There's galaxies like Messier 65 and 66 just to the bottom of Leo there. And between Leo and those winter constellations, you've got the very faint constellation of Cancer, and that includes the lovely open cluster Messier 44, still easy to find and enjoy this time of year, and it has about 1,000 stars in it. You won't see all of those, but you'll certainly find it easy to see a few tens of stars with a small telescope. And finally, in terms of planets, in the morning sky, if you're up and about even reasonably early, you'll see Venus is really stunning right now. It's pretty much as high as it'll be this year. Very, very, very obvious. If you see this bright object in the morning sky, please don't write to me about a UFO. It's not a UFO, it's Venus. And if you have a telescope and you look at it, you'll see that it's changing phase as it moves between around the sun, and you'll see it's shrinking down. It's moving away from us. The crescent it's got is shrinking down, but it's also fattening. It's also getting rounder. And it'll be about half full on the 20th of March.
And it's right next to Mars as well, isn't it, at the minute too?
It is right next to Mars, and Mars will be really great later in the year. And Mars, if you look at it, if you want a comparison, consider, you know, Mars is about half the size of the Earth, right? And it's significantly further away. But look at the difference in brightness between the two, you know, relatively faint red Mars next to stunning, brilliant white Venus. Those thick clouds in its atmosphere make it so bright.
You know,
it reflects
all
the sunlight so well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite jealous of the people who are further south than us at the minute. I mean, we did have Suraj from Mumbai earlier. So, I mean, those who are further south, you're going to get treated to not just Mars and Venus, but Mercury and Saturn too. It's like the morning is just like spoiling us at the minute with planets.
I know, and I didn't mention that because, yeah, in the UK, they're really hard to see. And Mercury is, there are definitely times a year in the UK when you can see Mercury fairly easy. They're very brief fleeting periods, and we will... I promise to keep an eye on when it's good, and I'll be mentioning that too. But you're absolutely right. Further south, I mean, generally, actually, if you're down on the equator or getting close to the equator, you see the whole night sky. You know, we're always a little bit restricted that much further north.
I just think this means we have to do an on-location podcast recording, to be honest.
Absolutely. From the equator, no, I'd be up for that. Yeah. Or Australia.
Well, we'll work on that. But I think that's it for this month. So we'll be back in March with a look at galaxies.
I know, again,
another topic that I'm like, okay, let's cross this off the list as well. How have we not done an episode on galaxies? So actually, we're going to do two episodes on galaxies because there's just so much. And we're also going to be back with our Space Book Club as well.
Yay. And remember, tweet us if you try some astronomy at home. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter, or email your questions to podcast@ras.ac.uk, and we'll try and cover them in a future episode. Episode? What's an episode? And we'll try and cover them in a future episode. Until then, though, happy stargazing. I'm saying happy at the same time as episode.
I almost just laughed all over your entire line. I was like, hold it in, hold it in.
I was holding it together, doing the line. What's an episode?
That was fun.